I'm not going to say it's a blessing in disguise, because it's not. We always want to hear as many youth out there as there are. But presenter number 7 was going to talk to the issue of surrogate motherhood. She unfortunately had to leave to catch a plane because coming from out of town, that if they are having serious difficulties with travel arrangements and so on, that they would have approached the committee secretary to see if we can't fast track them. I think the locals can tolerate some degree of inconvenience, because it wouldn't involve missing flights. On that note, unless there's any change in the schedule at this stage, we proceed to the 8th presenter, and that is the independent it's an independent consultant. It's a Miss Carol Bauer. Miss Carol Bauer, please proceed.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for this opportunity to present here today. I'd like to start by commending the Portfolio Committee and the decision makers on the very far-sighted piece of legislation that they are putting in place here. We felt for a long time in the children's sector that we needed new legislation, and it's very encouraging to see the extent to which it's dealing with the really difficult issues that are facing children in South Africa today. I'm an independent consultant now, but until July last year, I worked in RAPCAN, an organization dealing with children's rights based in Cape Town, where I was the director. And for the last several years, and including up to the present, I have been engaged with the Children's Bill in its various incarnations. And I still have a strong commitment to seeing its passage to the end. But I'm also a member of a group of organizations that have been working on the corporal punishment issue. So I don't represent an organization as such here today, but I am speaking at least in part for that subgroup of organizations. There are many reasons to prohibit corporal punishment. There are rights arguments which can be made, including our international obligations in terms of the Convention on the Rights of the Child and our own constitution. Colleagues from the Human Rights Commission who are going to present later will be able to talk much more articulately to those issues. A very important issue is that children are vulnerable. When we hear about four-year-olds getting hidings, then we realize that tiny children whose bone structure and emotional development are very immature, how dangerous that can be when they are put into that situation. So children are physically and emotionally enormously vulnerable to that kind of behavior. But perhaps one of the most important things we need to understand about corporal punishment, particularly in this context, is that it does not work. There is ample research evidence to suggest that the only positive spin-off from corporal punishment is immediate compliance. In my written submission, I refer to the research by Elizabeth Gershoff, which has made this unequivocally plain. It's recent research, it was very thoroughly undertaken, very scientific research, and it shows quite clearly that the only thing that corporal punishment achieves is immediate compliance. If that's what we want to do, well, that's an argument, but I would dispute that it's what we want to do. Not only does it not have any long-term positive effects in terms of discipline, but corporal punishment can be extremely damaging. And I'd like to quote from the same study, which found that corporal punishment has the following effects, and there is quite a long list of them, if you will bear with me. Decreased moral internalization, increased child aggression, increased child delinquent and antisocial behavior, decreased quality of relationship between parent and child, decreased child mental health, increased risk of being a victim of physical abuse, increased adult aggression, increased adult criminality, increased adult antisocial behavior, decreased adult mental health, increased risk of abusing one's own spouse or child, and immediate compliance. That was the one good thing that comes out of hitting children. What do we teach children when we hit them? We do teach them a lesson, unfortunately. What we teach them is that if I'm bigger than you and stronger than you and I don't like what you're doing, then I can hurt you. What we teach them is about power. The idea that one should take a four-year-old into a situation, remove its underwear and beat it, and then embrace it. We are confusing love and pain to a frightening degree when we do those kinds of things. And the best of all is that there is an alternative. It's completely unnecessary to hit children. With all these negative consequences that corporal punishment has, the research evidence, practical experience is absolutely clear. Positive discipline is a far more effective way to raise disciplined adults who can live in a society that is just and equitable without hurting anybody else. If you look at one of the things that people say a lot is what you do instead. Well, this is not going to be a workshop on how to discipline children positively. But one of the difficulties that we find when we work around the abolition of corporal punishment is firstly people fail to understand that to advocate for the prohibition of corporal punishment is not to advocate for the prohibition of discipline. There are in fact two entirely different things. Isn't it perhaps true that what's wrong in our society today is that it's okay to hurt people who are weaker than you are. It's fine to take whatever I want. It doesn't matter how I affect other people. Is that not some of what is actually wrong with our society today? The evidence is unmistakable. The links between violence in society and corporal punishment are absolutely established. And remember, please, that we live in one of the most violent societies on earth. It's time to think about raising our children differently. It's time to take a different standpoint. I'd like to pick up on just a couple of points that were made by earlier speakers. It was said in this House that this is the first time, and I quote, that the legislature has interfered in the private life of South Africans. That is simply not true. The domestic violence legislation, the sex offences legislation, are all designed to protect at least in part, people in the private domain, within the home. So this is by no means a first. There seems to be some idea that we're going to criminalize parents, that every little smack is going to cause four-year-olds to storm the nearest police station and demand redress. The fact is that the vast majority of children who are seriously abused do not lay charges. That is not going to change. In addition, our law is very clear. It does not concern itself with that which is trivial. And that is not going to happen. Points have been made about the religious issues, of course, have been made extensively, and I'm not going to go into those. The South African Council of Churches submission did that very well. But the cultural issues I would like to address. I think we tend to forget that corporal punishment was brought to us by the colonials. It was entrenched by apartheid. In fact, it was used as part of entrenching apartheid. And please forgive my pronunciation, but there are some sayings in local languages which I would like to bring to the attention of this House. From the Xhosa, Imbeko anatiwa ngoswazi, respect does not get built to a stick. In the Zulu, Induku ayinamdi, beatings don't build a home. Again in the Zulu, Mtana akuliswa ngoswazi. And then in Tonga, Ngo Ayi Akimut. Basically, those things are all saying you don't raise a child with a stick, you don't raise a family with a stick, you don't raise reasonable human beings with a stick. That is our African culture. Two Africans of note, one the chairperson of the African Committee of Experts on the Rights and Welfare of the Child, the other the Ghanaian First Lady, have both said that corporal punishment is incompatible with African culture and incompatible with raising disciplined adults who can run a democracy and live in an equitable and just society. Another point that I'd like to raise is that corporal punishment, or sorry, the abolition of corporal punishment, and indeed this whole bill and the act that it is amending, are about protecting the rights of the most vulnerable children. We cannot guarantee that every South African child is going to be raised in a family which is healthy and supportive. In fact, right now, we do not have an abolition of corporal punishment, and that is not what's happening for a lot of South African children. It's currently the case that corporal punishment is not prohibited. I don't think that's making any difference for children in terms of living in a supportive and loving environment. One of the most amazing things about this piece of legislation is that it acknowledges that government has a role to play in education, in awareness raising, in direct support to build parenting capacity. This bill has stressed very, very strongly that the best place to raise a child is in a family which is supportive and caring. When people say, as they have, that this bill is interfering in your rights as a parent, that it's trying to take over your role as a parent, that it's undermining the role of parents, that is simply not true. If you carefully read all 300 odd clauses of this piece of legislation, it becomes very clear that what we are doing here is trying to build capacity in families, trying to ensure that children are raised in an environment which is conducive to raising happy and healthy adults, their own homes, which is clearly the best place to do it. Finally, and I'm almost finished, I would like to point out that hitting children who have had their underwear removed, embracing them afterwards, and doing so in a bathroom is highly problematic as to be communicated as a way to go around these issues. Aside from the bedroom, the next most common place where sexual abuse is perpetrated is in the bathroom. There are connotations around the invasion of privacy and the lack of dignity of those acts that are extremely dangerous in the long term. And as I said before, the conflation of love and pain is a very, very difficult thing to deal with. The final point that I would like to make, and we've heard it repeatedly again today, and I'm sorry that the member of the House who makes these points is not here at present, but the issue of trying to distinguish between loving parental discipline and abuse. I would really like to know who draws those lines, who makes those decisions, who polices those things. What I think is violent and unreasonable, somebody else will think is neither violent nor unreasonable. How can we try, even begin to try, to quantify those kinds of issues? We have an obligation and an opportunity here to start to create the kind of society that we would like to live in. A society which is just, which is equitable, and which is full of responsible, self-disciplined adults who can live their lives and sustain themselves without hurting other people. I urge this House to take this opportunity and make sure that that's what we do. Thank you.
Quite a compelling argument indeed. I'll open the opportunity for people who want clarity. I think the presentation is fairly straightforward, but there's still room for members who wish to answer. Madiraka, you want to lead? Oh, okay. Is that Ms. Weber who wants to answer the question? Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for that really interesting presentation. We've spoken a lot about education. Now, I would like to just put it to you, who is supposed to be educated? Because I think this is fundamental. I agree with you 100% in the presentation, but I feel that we have got to be educated. Though it's all written in the bill, but there has got to be education of parents because, as you say, if you're so instilled to use some sort of abuse or spanking or whatever, but how are we going to get these people to educate them in a way that they can discipline without violence? Thank you.
I want to underline a point you made, that the law does not concern itself with children. I think it's an important statement in the context of this. I saw an article in the Sowetan, I think it was, as we were doing our rounds in the rural areas with a bull, which had a cartoon of this child who broke a vase. And the mother asked the question to the child, what happened, and the child said, "I'm not saying another word before I see my lawyer." So that's how trivialized this matter can be. But to the sense of humor, I think that's what the media is there for. It's not just there to inform, but to also entertain. But I must say, as a dad of a 12-year-old girl, 14-year-old son, talking of my girl. I don't recall an occasion when upset as I may have been because of her intransigence, because I can assure you, Khonsi has a mind of her own, and she insists on it. I hope she doesn't take some of my my attributes. But she definitely sticks to her point, even if she's wrong. But I've never found myself in a situation where I find myself compelled to use force to put pressure on her to subject herself to my point. And the thought of doing it just makes me shiver. I must concede I grew up getting a hiding. I don't know how frequently. That's why I asked the gentleman, how often do you smack your 4-year-old? And he said he certainly didn't smack him this week. So I assume we don't know whether he smacked him last week. But, on that note, I just want to respond to this. Yeah, looks like there isn't much. Any questions, please?
Thank you for that question. I'm glad that it was raised, because that is something we are always asked. The reality is that if this House and this Portfolio Committee and these decision makers give us the ban that is currently in the law, the real work starts then. Everything up until now has not been the real work. We need the legal prohibition for many, many reasons. But the real work starts once we've got it. One of the difficulties with talking to people about physical punishment of children is that to raise children with positive discipline, to raise children without hitting them, requires a great deal more from the parents. It requires that you set an example of how to be in the world, how to live life, how to make sensible decisions, how not to hurt other people. So really we need to start with parenting. Who's going to do it? Well, there are lots of cases already doing it. There are lots of people, there are lots of parents in this country who do not believe in hitting their children. I have a 24-year-old daughter. She's never had a hiding in her life. I wouldn't even dream of hitting her, neither of any of her friends. It is actually something that is happening more and more and more. And we need to find ways to provide awareness-raising, conscientizing, and alternatives to parents. Instead of hitting, we need to provide positive alternatives. We can take heart from the fact that if we do prohibit, we are the 19th country globally to do so. And contrary to what we are often told by people who want to not ban, what's going to happen? Are we going to end up with children like they've got in UK and USA? Remember that the UK and the US, they have not prohibited corporal punishment. Greece has. Lots of other much more peaceful, loving, nice countries have. But the UK and the USA have not. So if we want to be different to them, then better be banned. We need the NGOs are doing a lot of this work already. We're going to need support. We're going to have to work together with government. But that we can do it is absolutely certain. In one generation in Sweden, in one generation, they swung the figures from 5% against the prohibition to 95% against it. I'm sorry, for the prohibition. They swung it around. Before they banned in 1979, Swedish parents didn't believe it was possible to raise children without hitting them. In one generation, they changed those figures. But they put a lot of effort into it. There were messages about anti-corporal punishment on every milk carton that was sold in Sweden. It was on posters. It was everywhere. It's going to take work and effort, make no mistake. But it can be done, it has been done, and it will be done again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On that note,
Well, the presenter comes, I think I must say, I'm waiting for the actual work, because the one time I promised to take my 4-year-old to a movie and my flight was late, and before I even greeted her, she said, "Don't talk to me, talk to my lawyer." And so I had to ask who the lawyer is, and she said, "My sister, because you are late." So. And I mean, but also just on a more serious note, I think what we need to say is to begin to, I mean, if you remember during our time, when you ask a question, an inquisitive child, when the poor child is trying to explore, what is that, I'm busy with my own counting 1 + 1, that would be 11 instead of 2, and I'm too impatient to attend to the inquiring mind that's been growing. And the best way to start the charge is, yeah. And the person is just trying to ask, why is that bad having to, whatever. And today it's the same thing. If your child asks, I mean, my children ask the Lord and they talk. And when we are among friends, it will be like, hey, banaba haba buya haholo, you know. Why banaba haba? And then it's my responsibility to say, no, but actually they are not. They are growing minds. They are just inquiring about what's happening around them. And as we spend time with parents, those that are around them, we begin to check, to say, look, actually our minds have been suppressed. Hence that our parents' minds were suppressed by apartheid. They passed that on us. Let's check the children's minds state. And I feel like we're cool. It's not hitting, but it's still abusive.
Thank you for those informative comments. Can we proceed to the next presenter? And that is presenter number 9. That is Doctors for Life. Please proceed. Are they here? They aren't here. Okay, it appears that Doctors for Life are not here. Save us some extra time. I'm told that we are then fast-tracking National Association of Child Care Workers. We my understanding is that we're going to fast-track some of the people who have applied and those kind of problems. Which number is it? Yeah, okay. We had two presenters that were by error not included on the list, but they did submit their application in time. And this is one of them. There's two of them. That's the other one. We can include Childline SA as well. Yeah. So those would be the two that are not on your list. But please proceed.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members of the House. Afternoon. Thank you for reminding me that day's gone long. My name is Alfred Harris, and I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Child Care Workers. Now, the Patrolling Committee has been exposed to, in other provinces, to the children presenting on the children's bill and their issues. And this afternoon, our focus of this presentation is going to be on the work of the people who care for those children presented to you in the other provinces. And those people are known as child and youth care workers. And at the moment, we want to first of all say that we acknowledge the fact that as a profession, not recognized it, although we have a professional board, our board has been constituted in 2005, but we are waiting for our regulations to be drafted, and this makes the work of child and youth care workers very problematic, the work in the field of youth care work very problematic, which we're going to be giving to you in due course. Now, first of all, to give you a background of what a child youth care worker is, basically it is a worker that provides direct life-based work in the lives of vulnerable and children in trouble with the law, which means the child care workers work directly with children and they work with children in various settings. However, what we have at the moment in the our current challenges we're having at the moment, this is where we come to the portfolio committee to speak, particularly include child and youth care work in the bill as a profession other than other social service professions. Currently, we are in the bill as part of the social service professions, which is a broad spectrum of social service professionals, but we would like to be included with our roles and specific functions within the children's bill. So one of our challenges is the fact that we have a professional board, but we don't have regulations. Child and youth care workers are exposed
to give input into the regulations. However, at this current moment, we have got no idea as to where the regulations is, and that has got a negative impact upon services to young people. And also, what has also happened in a few countries, that we used to have a degree course where people could study, and one of the higher learning institutions has decided to stop the degree course, so which means that child healthcare work as a profession won't be, people coming from school now who would want to study child healthcare work won't be able to study child healthcare because the degree course has been taught by UNISA. And then also, to give further consideration to the social service professionals, the Department of Social Development has started a process of attracting young people to come and study social work. What we say is the similar things should be done for all other social service professionals, not only social work and SSEs. Now what we also want to just to give you briefly here this afternoon is just to give you a brief overview of the role that child healthcare workers play and where they work, so you can have an understanding and a bit of background that when you do deliberate, that you do also take this in cognizance. One of the places where child healthcare work is becoming more prominent at the moment is community-based care. With child healthcare workers work in the community, with families, where they actually teach people how to discipline their children. Where they actually go out and help mothers and fathers to deal effectively with raising their kids in a healthy environment and an environment that's care and protection for both parents and children. Because when we teach children, when we teach parents, we also protect the parent against hitting the child. We protect both, not only the one. Then also in terms of the earlier we heard the legal resource center spoke about the high incidence of HIV/AIDS in the country and the orphans that is coming from that. And as an organization, we have got started a program called Isibindi, where we actually place child and healthcare workers in the homes of either where the mother and father has passed away, so the children stay in their own environment, they remain there with the child and healthcare workers there to provide guidance and assistance for the children. And also child and healthcare workers also work in a family where the mother and father are maybe at stage 4 of HIV/AIDS, where they ensure that the development of the children is not negatively impacted by the imminent passing of the parents. So they will ensure that the children go to school, that everything that the mother and the father is supposed to be doing, the child care workers does that. And also we have child care workers that have been working all the year in what we call the general care facilities. At the moment we have three types, and we have the secure care centers where the children that commit horrendous crimes, hijacking, rape, robbery, armed robbery, are sent, and child workers work with those children. And also special safety with children go that is maybe don't want to go to school anymore, first offenders with tricky crimes like theft, housebreaking, stuff like that. Then also we have child care workers working in children's homes where children are placed on a more longer term basis, and where their role is to teach children appropriate behavior, and also where they interact with the possible foster care period where children will be placed after they have left the placement. And also, the bill also makes provision for partial care that your adopting centers, and child healthcare workers also work in those centers as well. And then also, we are aware that in KwaZulu-Natal, that child care workers in certain schools, they child care workers place, who work there, and they help young people to deal with their own difficult and challenging behavior, and it's a support function to the teachers. Furthermore, if you look at Section 194 of Norms of Fairness in Youth Care Centres, we see that there are 15 things that 15 norms of fairness that is indicated under Section 2 of what a youth care centre needs to do. Now, most of those things is work that child youth care workers do when they work with young people in a youth care centre. Okay? And then also, now, obviously, if there isn't a professional board for child and youth care workers to register at, we can actually see this progress with that. The one thing is there's no code of ethics whereby child and youth is compelled to work again. So which means children can be abused, and we heard this morning in the first presentation that there's high instances of abuse happening within facilities with children, because there's no code of ethics for child and youth care workers to work at.
The presentation also alludes to the fact that cells are kept in horrendous conditions. Now, if they are cold and itchy, we start healthcare workers have to work against them. Those men would have to be deported, because otherwise those are healthcare workers could be held responsible if they continue to keep kids in that condition. And I mean, we've recently seen on the TV of a place in Pretoria, a private security center, where kids were kept in conditions which are inhumane for their own health. So the first thing that you will see is that there will no code of ethics, so people probably are liable. But the other thing that can happen with that is that people can work in the Western Cape, they can abuse young people, they can go to an Eastern Cape, they can work with children again. Because there's no record, there's no fallout that we can abuse, there's no legislation for them. And also want to say that in section 209(1)(b), it refers to staff or other appropriate people to be employed. And we are saying that needs to be clarified and be specific and should lead child rescue workers or people with the necessary skill and training in child rescue work to work in those centers. Because if we allow any other person to work, then we will have a continuation of untrained people working with vulnerable children, whether they are at risk with their own behavior, whether they are in trouble with the law, but they will be exposed to be worked with untrained people. And I wonder, my question always thinks about this, is I wonder how many of us will go to see a doctor who hasn't completed his medical studies if we must operate on us, if we will be happy to work with that. And then also, we also see that because there's no code of ethics, no standard set for child rescue workers, we unfortunately position with child rescue workers, particularly in the private sector, are faced challenges that I don't think some of us spend on buying dog food for our monthly dog food for our animals. So we have to really look at making sure that we as a prison are registered and recognized within the children's goal. So what do we want from this patrolling committee to have to deliberate on? It's ensure that child rescue workers included in the bill as a separate profession from other social service professions. Okay? The child rescue workers, there's a similar program of attracting young people to come and study child rescue work that is done for social work. It's done for child and rescue workers. And then at the present moment, because we don't have a study course at the higher learning institutions, government actually should actually instruct and make sure that there is a course with people who want to study further can go and study, because at the moment we have people in the field who want to continue to study, but were told by the higher learning institutions that they won't be taking on any more students. The people are now can't continue with their studying. And then also there are people, 6,000 child rescue workers to other countries, both public and private, who's waiting anxiously to be registered and want to further their studies in the field of child rescue. So thank you.
Thank you for that input. I'm open for interaction. Are there any members who want to raise any questions? Of course, we did have a number of instances where we used the presentation from the organization and had a whole contingent of young people talk to us, I think, Tata and elsewhere. So by now, I think the members are very familiar with your work. Any questions or comments from members? Then we will proceed. Thank you very much for your contribution. Let's proceed to deal with the next. We're going back to number 10, and that is the Catholic Institute of Education, CIED. Well, let me indicate that I serve on the board. I'll try and recuse myself if need be. There is a board that, but anyway. Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, thank you for this opportunity to present to you. Luckily for the chair, I'm representing the Caring School Network today, one of the other hats that I wear, so he may not have to recuse himself after all. What I'm going to speak to you today about is the role of schools in the children's bill. I believe that in the community participation and in many other forums, people have discussed, well, what can the possible role of schools be in dealing with children? But before I go on, I'll give you about 10 minutes with my speech and give time for questions. The Caring Schools Network is a network of civil society organizations, universities, research institutions, international donors, local donors, and government departments. And they're all involved with work around schools and around bringing services and interventions to school communities in South Africa. And what we've recognized with in particular prospects to the children's bill is that with the education for all requirements, there's near universal enrollment in primary schools. The department estimates that 98% of children of school-going age in primary school are in school. At secondary school level, it's about 85%. And importantly enough, if we're going to, as this bill intends to do, create a whole host of services and interventions, there's two sort of things that will need to happen in terms of implementation. One is we'll need to upscale the level of intervention and services that we have, and the other side of it is that we need to outscale all the levels of intervention so we can reach even the deepest rural areas. And the easiest way to do that would be to do it through the schools network. Another important thing to note, and this comes from some research from the Dean of Education at the University of Cape Town, is that the epidemic, the HIV/AIDS pandemic, migration, just the legacies, structural legacies of our past, have led to a situation in South Africa where amongst middle-class homes, there are 120 older people to each 100 young people, whereas under previously disadvantaged communities, there are about 10 older people to each 100 young people. You can immediately see the problems that that raises with issues of parenting, with issues of families, with issues of looking after children. And this is a critical thing that this bill intends to do. In this sense, schools themselves have become an alternative family in areas where there has been a breakdown of families. And teachers have been taking on roles far outside the call of their normal educational training, as it were. And what we were actually asking this committee to do and Parliament and government to seriously consider is to support those teachers who are currently playing that role. And to, in addition to that, with all the other intentions behind the bill, to continue to support the family structures so that we can eventually wean off the need for teachers and schools to play this family role. But how do we propose to do this? Effectively, there are three recommendations, and I'll read out the actual clauses. The one is, the bill will set up all these interventions and services. So initially, the education department in the country needs to deal with a way of coming up with a system to identify and refer children who are in need of services to the relevant services that are created by the bill. Secondly, the Department of Social Development will have the responsibility of providing these services as intended in the bill. And for the sake of for the purpose of the role of schools clause, we're really looking at this in Chapter 8, the Prevention and Intervention Services, although it could extend to other chapters beyond that. And thirdly, as with everything to do with government, you need to have quite a great deal of intersectoral cooperation. And we would recommend very strongly that in wording of such a clause, that the relevant stakeholders and the lead players are actually identified. So what we've suggested is the insertion of a new clause in the Chapter 8, which would say the following. The MEC of Education in each province must establish and maintain for all schools in the province a mechanism for the identification, referral, and support of children. Just note the lack of vulnerable there. Just to make a note that although the term vulnerable children is used quite a bit, children by definition, by being children, are vulnerable, and there are different levels at which this term is used within the bill. But in this case, we're talking about vulnerable children or children. It's pretty much the same thing. The clause goes on into three sub-clauses. One, in developing the mechanism, the MEC, in order to give effect to Section 5 of this Act, must consult with the MEC for Social Development, MEC for Health, and members of civil society providing social services to children. Subsection 2, the mechanism must be structured in a way which ensures the delivery of social services to vulnerable children in an integrated and coordinated manner, provision for the appointment and funding of social service professionals and paraprofessionals and other support personnel within the education system to provide social services to vulnerable children and to link children with appropriate social service providers. And thirdly, the MEC must ensure that the mechanisms established in terms of this section is monitored to ensure the delivery of services. And with that, Chair, I'll leave the members have questions.
Thank you very much. I think we're doing very well with time. We're making up for some of that lost time before lunch. Are there any questions from members? Okay. Looks like things are fairly straightforward. Yes, Magomede.
Somewhere in the recommendation, the gentleman said the government should see that what is the schools in the province. Now, I just want to find out whether he means a particular province or all the provinces. Thank you.
Response? I think that particular clause refers to, because education is a provincial competence, it would have to be delivered from a provincial level, so it's the MEC of education in each province. So it would apply nationally to all of them, but just to recognize where the mandate lies for the provision of education, we would suggest the clause be written that way.
Okay, thank you very much. You are released. Are you making a concluding comment?
Yeah. Well, just a comment. I think if I had to try and set up a problem, it was interesting this morning. There were two groups of school children in this hall. And it just, I think, for the committee and everybody just realized that's sort of where children get access to government, is really through that school. And it couldn't have highlighted that any more if I'd planned it. But it actually wasn't planned by me.
On that note, thank you very much. We are going to proceed to the next presentation, number 11, from the Christian Action Network. Please come forward. Your opportunity to be the star of the day.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. The Christian Action Network made a submission regarding the issue of parental corporal punishment to the South African Law Reform Commission back in 2003. The Christian Action Network is an umbrella body of Christian congregations and organizations that stand together in the socio-political arena to uphold the lordship of Jesus Christ in all areas of life. CAN represents its 40 member organizations to government and to the media. We put out press statements, make submissions and representations to Parliament, and present a coordinated voice on mutual concerns shared by the member organizations. The Christian Action Network has consistently made submissions to Parliament regarding legislative threats to the family and the lives of preborn babies for the last 16 years. We will simply be concentrating our submission on Section 139 of the Bill that deals with corporal punishment. The implication of this section is that all spanking, hiding, and smacking will be outlawed. It will effectively turn law-abiding, diligent parents into criminals overnight. If a father reasonably disciplines his own child and then is charged with...
English is the second language. What's the difference between spanking, hiding, and smacking?
I think it's basically the same thing. It's just different words. If a father reasonably disciplines his own child and then is charged with assault, he will have no defense available in law. Before this bill, unreasonable chastisement was outlawed, and this protected children from abuse. However, to specifically outlaw reasonable chastisement is to force parents to neglect their biblical and civic duty to discipline their children. In Proverbs 13, verse 24, it says, "He who spares the rod hates the son, but he who loves him is careful to discipline him." An outright ban on smacking could not be consistently enforced. It would waste police time on trivial incidences while genuine cases of child abuse go unchecked. A ban is not necessary. An ordinary smack is not child abuse. Most parents smack their children at some point. Does Parliament believe they are all child abusers? Nor does smacking teach children that violence is the answer. Most people were smacked as a child and are now perfectly peaceful citizens. Sweden has had a smacking ban for over 20 years, and it has been a disaster. Child abuse has actually increased. Children have become more violent, and more children have been taken away from their parents by the authorities. One of the other speakers earlier mentioned that this law had changed perceptions on smacking, and I have a very useful critique of some of the research that was cited. It's called "Sweden Smacking Ban: More Harm Than Good" by Robert E. Lagerlöf, PhD, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And this can be made available to any of the members should you want to read it. To say that children should have the same protection...
But what is the essence of what you're saying?
They're saying
the Swedish society has become more violent?
That child abuse has actually increased. That the purpose of the bill, which is also being cited here today, is that they're wanting to prevent child abuse by banning corporal punishment. Now, in Sweden, corporal punishment was banned, but child abuse has actually increased. It hasn't done the purpose for which it was made, so it's actually been completely useless. To say children have the same protection under law as adults is an absurd oversimplification. There are many differences in law for children. For obvious reasons, children are not allowed to drink alcohol, purchase cigarettes, drive, marry, vote, or own a firearm license. And no one claims equality on these issues. It's a vocal minority that is calling for a total ban on all forms of physical punishment. They say that all smacking is child abuse, but most people would disagree. If you go out into the streets and to interview members of the public, you would find that most people disagree that there's a world of difference between abuse and loving discipline. The greatest form of child abuse is abortion, and pornography on ETV is child abuse. Loving discipline is not child abuse. Of course, it is never right for a parent to spank when they have lost their temper, nor should a parent discipline a child for being a child. It would be indefensible to smack a child who simply made a child's mistake. All parents should never have inappropriate expectations or put impossible demands on their children. All this represents bad parenting. But banning all smacking is unnecessary and frankly unworkable. Child abuse is already illegal. Social workers and the police certainly have their work cut out, keeping up with the number of cases, but the lawmakers have failed to explain how there are problems with the existing law. So our main point is that the existing law is firm enough and fair enough to protect children. Loving discipline by parents can prevent abuse and can save lives. So our recommendation is remove the ban on corporal punishment from section 139 of the bill and leave the existing law as it is. Lastly, I would just like to remind the committee that in 1996, 80% of the submissions were against the termination of pregnancy bill. 96% of the submissions were against the Film and Publications Bill, which legalized pornography. 90% of the submissions were against the Civil Unions Bill. So to again go against the will of the people in this issue will again make a part of the democracy which parliamentarians so readily pay lip service to.
Thank you very much. That's provoking. It's an opportunity for members to interact in submission. Are there any questions anybody wishes to ask? Maybe I should take off and ask the question. Do you want to start back?
No, she's asking for a copy of submission.
Oh, okay. I'm sure an arrangement can be made. I just wanted to find out, you referring to reasonable society, which is, of course, the common law condition currently. Now, obviously, the common law itself evolved in a particular situation, social context. Society is ever-changing. It is clear that even the frequency of the use of corporal punishment in society generally seems to be diminished. Maybe my assessment is wrong. What would be reasonable in the use of physical violence against a person, irrespective of whether a child or not? I mean, isn't violence in itself an unreasonable act, especially in a modern system where violence is generally regarded as a sign as unacceptable? Wouldn't you see it difficult to determine a point at which you could say that this is acceptable degree of inflicting violence to a point where you could call it agreement? But let me allow other people to have questions.
The research, is that the same research that the Justice Alliance was referring to, which found that there was no evidence that reasonable corporal punishment is harmful when they were trying to prove that it was harmful? Is that the same research or different? And then just to go on, you mentioned there it would be indefensible to snap a child who simply made a child's mistake and parents would never have inappropriate expectations of putting possible demands on their children. Are you suggesting there that obviously education in terms of parenting is a necessary thing, which of course is something that comes up over and over in terms of the goals and the aims of this bill? And I want to ask, you've given a suggestion here that we revert back to the previous wording. Would you have any objection to one or other of the submissions that were being made, the one where I suggested that we just simply add in 159.2, no child may be subjected to unreasonable corporal punishment or be punished in a cruel, inhumane, and degrading way? Taking out number 3 and making that adjustment. At the same time, there was another proposal that actually suggested a definition and suggested that just by including that definition of what parental corporal punishment was, that would actually bring a desired result on both sides of the story. Would you have any objection to that proposal? Do you need me to be more specific on that proposal?
No, I think a definition would be very useful.
Could be a question, wanting to clear my mind out of something. You know, Chairperson, we have already addressed this thing this morning today. Really, you cannot limit corporal punishment. Moreover, that you are punishing the child because the child is a sense of getting wrong. And it was said the biggest wrong is the one that you can apply corporal punishment to. Now, if academics was the biggest wrong, but get the biggest punishment, you can't punish somebody lightly for having done the biggest issue. Now, temper is a natural thing. Now, you know, it's next. If you have this scientist and I want to give a CEO the snack, then I thought I'm not enforcing that snack. But due to the pressure that is hitting me for being cross of what the child has done, then I automatically just, that hand goes across to a beyond the snack that is choosing. Like here it says, an outside hand on snack would not be consistent. Then it says, an ordinary snack is not silent. Now, the Constitution will say, let's make it an ordinary snack. But ultimately, due to the pressure of being cross, then I overdo it. Then I respect the Constitution that no, I wanted to make it an ordinary snack, but most unfortunately, it became a big snack.
The point to be added there is that very often corporal punishment goes with a particular state of emotion in the person inflicting the corporal punishment. And the question becomes, to what extent does revenge, for example, not become the primary driver in inflicting the punishment, as opposed to trying to maintain discipline. Somebody is very angry because the child has done something they perceive to be very wrong, and they use force to assert their emotions on the child. Again, the question, how could that not be addressed? Is it possible to separate the emotional side from the physical act? But those are the questions that we can respond to all of them. Oh, is there another question?
Yes.
Please. Oh. Is it working?
Am I allowed to speak here on corporal punishment?
You are a member of parliament, and therefore all members of parliament can attend and speak at any committee meetings. Chair of ANC conference, you are welcome. Feel free to speak.
Thank you very much. So I've been earlier watching the proceedings from my office, but later on I got cut out, electronically. But as you know, I had passionately spoken to you about this before, and I have declared my intention to come and participate. And I was targeting the time when we would be speaking about corporal punishment. I would not talk about the issue of condoms, etc., for H12, although that was another issue that I raised with you.
That issue has been dealt with throughout the day.
No, I know. I know, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm only talking about corporal punishment.
No, I'm talking about corporal punishment.
Yes.
This morning.
Alright, yes.
It's not coming up on
me. It shows you how the whole country is worried about it. Chair, my worry is about the state. You know, if we are not careful and conscious, we could be moving towards a situation where the state over-regulates private life. I think the state is there to set parameters in terms of ensuring law and order, civil obedience, etc., etc. But I think we must discuss this issue with a full consciousness and a refusal to over-regulate private life. Where I say this fully aware of our responsibility as a state to protect human rights, including children's rights, parents' rights, etc., etc. I am worried. I have two kids. The first child is 16. In her whole lifetime, I have spanked her only 3 times. My son is not here. I have spanked him about 6 times, although he's only 12. All the times it was with love. I worry about them when they are parents. When we have, as a state, regulated that they can't spank their children, when we fail as a society increasingly to offer alternative measures and assistance to society to deal with problems that are challenging us, that we are even now seeking to only come into clamp down in terms of regulating and policy and writing laws as a state, without necessarily balancing that with solving social evils that may manifest themselves in the household when children are very small and may graduate into public disorder of some sort or form in others' lives. So I came here to raise my objection as a member of parliament, freely as an individual, to corporal punishment, but to banning corporal punishment in the household. But I am open to conviction. I am just stating my plea to the committee that I'm talking to you now as a parent, worried about my grandchildren, that they will never be spanked when they are being molded as children. And secondly, that as a state, we should be careful not to want to over-regulate private life. Thank you.
I don't know what to say. You stated your case as an individual, not as a member of parliament, rather than react from the case. Perhaps we will.
Thank you, teacher. Chairperson, I wouldn't like to challenge the view of the chairperson of Focus. No, for one. I'm just making my children out of my own, not out of the constitution. Out of my own, it's my own responsibility for this stuff. And let us not want somebody to impose after tomorrow must take responsibility for what I have done. For us in the constitution to say yes, not your children. That is a slight fact. We agree to it. Constitution and letters, the letters we are assuming. Then I overdo it. See? If it is out of my own private life, then I have met my guy. And automatically I do it overdid it due to some certain circumstances. It is my own thing, like the chairperson is saying. Let us say it's our own private life and what. But the constitution must not be our weapon when something wrong has happened. Because here in South Africa, people are misinterpreting the whole constitution. It's all misinterpretations all over. Now, we take it very light as a community right now. But at the end, it will be like all the other things being misinterpreted. Even the constitution. Go and look at the constitution. Touch them so. Say I can snap you. Meanwhile, I have read the time. But especially a time that is not mine. Because if we are saying yes, let's corporal punishment be introduced today. Then it should be exercised in school. I mean, even as a Sunday school teacher, when I was her age, I was making them right inside the church. Right inside. Because the children are naughty. All what we are saying here is, let us not legalize it so that after tomorrow it must be our responsibility that we agreed for people to be selected. And there is nobody whoever intends of hurting his or her own child. We do hurt our children. Our husbands do hurt us. But most of them, it's not intentional. It's overreacting when you are in the action. Because that child will be saying, ah, no, mama, you can't go to Arisa. You see? Trying to pull that your head out of him. For especially when they become 12, 14. You see? For especially when the father is not there at times. Then the child starts saying, ah, mama, mama. Then you just take him and push him towards the wall. Then it's corporal punishment that is introduced by the constitution of this country. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I know that we're hijacking this particular submission, but I would really like... sorry, I thought...
Your chair has hand up first. I am too.
Thanks, Honourable Douglas. I just want to ask the presenter on her opinion. Yes. That share the children which have the same protection on the Lord adult as they observe over specifications. But I'm sure I'd like her opinion on whether she believes that children are more vulnerable, in fact, than adults, so they need more protection. And she also talks about the well-organized children's charities and child rights groups. But the fact that they're child rights groups really means they have the interests of children at heart. And we talk about children's rights and human rights. We then go on to talk about reasonable people saying that the world is different between abuse and loving discipline. But the problem is that it's when people are not reasonable, they inflict the kind of punishment on children that then becomes abuse. So once again, we open to the interpretation of what is reasonable and who's defining the reasonable. That's a comment.
In fact, I was going to ask if I could question the Honourable Member. So, you know, so either way, it may just, because she sort of brought a certain viewpoint, should I do that afterwards? But it did, we did sort of go here, so it's, yes. Or responding or commenting. Can I do that? All right, I just appreciate the input that Honourable Member has given, and especially the Honourable Member on my left here was speaking about 15-year-olds who have never had guidelines and discipline in their coming up. That is when there is child abuse, because the children have not had my experience, like your experience, would have been my little one would have got a smack, and 6 months later, I would never have to give a smack until then, and then it would be a year later, and then you'd never give a smack again. And so you don't have 15-year-olds that you want to throw up against the wall, because you have kids who understand that there are boundaries, and you clearly mark those boundaries for them, and they grow up in a safe, secure environment, and I'm assuming that was probably where you were going with that. Now, what I was going to just ask you, the Honourable Member, was how does she feel about, you know, the fact that reasonable chastisement is what the current situation is? We're not talking about any kind of beating or hitting of children. The terminology in the legislation has up till now been reasonable chastisement. Is your understanding of that has not been good enough to protect children from the abuse and violence, or would you say that clause and that legislation hasn't been used effectively in protecting them? So I'm trying to say, what are we saying here? What is the problem? Is it the legislation that's not adequate, or is it that we haven't used the legislation adequately?
Well, definitions would certainly help here to make the legislation clearer.
I certainly agree with Ms. Dundee's point that we do need to define exactly what what violence and abuse is, for example, including with such a grievous bodily harm in child abuse. But having said that, children, while they do need rights, they don't need to have privileges that are only, that are afforded to people who are old enough to make important decisions like parents do. So, children don't need the same rights as parents. They need to have, and so the law is, as it is firm enough, but it perhaps does need to be clarified as to what reasonable chastisement is. And so, again.
I didn't share. Always. Madam Chair, honourable members and colleagues, good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity to allow the forum to put forward its submission orally as well. I'm Rajesh Lachman. I lead the National Welfare Forum and Dr. Jackie Lefell. Our presentation is going to start with a brief outline by Jackie about the current situation in the foster care system, and then I will discuss the possible ways forward thereafter. Okay.
Thank you. We have made a submission attached to which is a discussion paper, and this has a lot of facts and figures to provide context to what I'll be saying. So I won't go into all those details, but there is a lot of material for you to refer to back up the essential points we'll be making. What we're dealing with at the moment is a huge crisis in the whole social service system, particularly the system that is dealing with children and families. And it is the result of a deluge of foster care cases which is completely paralyzing the child protection system. And in the discussion document, you will see that there's been a spiraling of numbers of children coming into foster care. If we start with the year 2000 as a baseline, there were something like 49,000 children in foster care. And that number had been fairly stable for a number of years before that. Since then, the numbers have been increasing by 50,000 a year. And as matters stand, we've been taking the year 2000 as a baseline, we've had approximately a 700% increase in the number of children in statutory foster care. That's a 700% increase in the numbers of children who are going to children's courts to be placed in foster care, and also who are going on to social work caseloads, and we know that we have a crisis of availability of social workers in the country. One of the most serious consequences of this is that, well, two most serious consequences of children who are needing financial assistance wait endlessly for such assistance. We've heard of children who are waiting for 2 years and more earlier this morning in some of the presentations. And the other part of the effect is on children who are needing protection from active abuse.
and these children are going unattended. And this is a reality on the ground, that our system for dealing with referred cases of abuse, neglect, abandonment, worse forms of child labor, etc., which already was not functioning by the year 2000 and had not been functioning properly for many years before that, was already in crisis. Now it's in an escalation of that crisis, which is paralyzed. And I would really suggest to members that they go and inquire from organizations on the ground everywhere around the country and find out what is happening with referred cases of abused children. It is a frightening situation. There are many other side effects to this, one of which is that social workers are in effect becoming social security clocks. There's a massive process of deploying social workers to address the foster care backlog. The Department of Social Development is headhunting social workers from every other type of service to put them to work in addressing the foster care backlog. This is leaving holes everywhere in the social service system, not just in child protection services. A lot of them are being taken from the very children's services. At one stage, I can tell you that in our own organization, the Johannesburg Child Welfare Society, we were sitting with 25 vacancies. And one of our biggest single departments is our foster care department. Foster care social workers are being poached from the NCOs to go and address foster care in the Department of Social Development. But these social workers are also being poached from services for the elderly, services for disability, services for addiction, all these other types of services that we need to be delivering. Because government offers much better salaries still than NGOs are able to offer with their present low subsidies, there is this continual movement of staff out of the NGO services. I would suggest that this is also causing severe damage to the service ethic among social workers. Social workers need to build up trust with their clients over months and years. What is happening is they are hopping from job to go to the highest bidder at the moment. They are not being formed, they are not being seasoned, they are not being mentored as they need to be at the beginning of their careers. They are in a process of jumping around, which is extremely damaging to every type of service, and I don't know what it's doing to overall the values of our profession and our overall service system in the end. Now, as the National Welfare Social Services Development Forum, we want to make it very clear that we absolutely support what government is trying to do through the foster care system, and that is to give orphans and vulnerable children access to social security and support services. This is an absolutely crucial challenge facing our country, and it's absolutely essential that we do meet the needs of these children. At the same time, we call for a very radical change in approach by the state on the issue of kinship care. We call for a collaborative approach which meets the needs of orphans and vulnerable children and allows them to access and enjoy their constitutional rights and also caters for the other urgent responsibilities of the social development sector. I've already spoken about the numbers of children in foster care. What we have to do first is look at who these children are. And if we look at the fact that foster care is first and foremost a protective service to children who are in need of such a service because of abuse, abandonment, and neglect, let's look at who is actually in what we are calling foster care at the moment. And in the recent survey, which was commissioned by the Department of Social Development, in the year 2005, 91% of children in foster care were with members of their extended family, mostly grandmothers or aunts. Only 6.3% were impaired due to maltreatment or inadequate parenting, and only 9.7% had been abandoned. So it's a very small proportion of these children that are in foster care for the reasons you would have considered that they should be in foster care. And at the same time, we have figures from Child Welfare South Africa who tell us that the Child Welfare Society countrywide are dealing with less abuse. That is not because there is less abuse. It's because this is where the services are being diverted. 48% of these children are full orphans and 80% of these children are half orphans. These are children who are in care because of the death of their parents, and they are already with their relatives, and they will remain with their relatives. This is a very different scenario from what we look at when we take an abused child out of a dangerous situation and place that child in foster care as a child protection service. Now, if we go from there to looking at what is happening with social workers, you've all seen the figures that have been calculated in terms of the costing of the children's bills. And if we look at even the lowest scenario for the figures of social workers, available social workers, by the year 2005-2006, we already needed 76% of the country's entire social work population, and we needed 76% of the social workers we had just to work with foster care, and that was 2 years ago. And we need to ask ourselves whether, and that was at the lowest level of service, not at the more appropriate upper levels of service that costing report outlined for us. We need to look at whether we can afford to have 76% of our social workers used in this one particular service. What is worse is that they're not performing social work in that service. They are performing what is basically a rubber stamping clerical function. There is no time for them to do proper social work investigations. There is certainly no time for them to do supervision and support services afterwards. So they are being used as glorified social assistance clocks. Can we afford to use our very scarce supply of social workers in such a way? And what is to happen to all the rest of our services, including the services to abuse, abandon, and neglect the children in the first place? Even if universities double or treble their present output, which at the last count is about 500 social workers a year, by the year 2010, we would be looking at the complete collapse of children's services, let alone the rest of the sector, and let you come with a radically different. What they're suggesting is that the developmental social welfare paradigm provides for such an approach. I'm going to let Rajesh carry on to talk about an alternative approach to the needs of orphaned and vulnerable children.
Thank you, Jackie. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've been listening to Jackie, you can see that we needed to paint this scenario for you so that you could then understand the context of our proposal. Now, what the National Welfare Forum is proposing is an alternative method of dealing with the situation. Now, we look at, we've spoken today about the imposition of European practices or cultures in Africa, and what we're ignoring is that in African culture, earlier speakers spoke about Ubuntu, and what is happening is orphans that the state considers homeless or without family are actually being cared for by their families at present. So these children are in fact already in kinship care. Now, while it may be out of the very strict terms of reference of this committee, what the forum is proposing is that we establish, at least recommend the establishment of a commission to investigate kinship care as an alternative means of care for orphans and vulnerable children in South Africa. 90% of orphans in foster care are now already being cared for by their family. So the reality is that people are not abandoning their children. The phenomenon of street children cannot be used as an example to say that children are being abandoned. Now, the basis of the input from the National Welfare Forum is not necessarily based around the traditional membership of the forum. It is based around a new face of the membership in the forum, which is community-based organizations working largely in the Northern Cape and in Mpopo province. So this proposal for kinship care is being informed by the people who are doing the work on the ground on a daily basis. And our recommendation to try and address this crisis is based on that, on the reality that is going on the ground, and on a system that is in tune with our local culture, that does not diminish the value and the roles that families play in looking after their children or their communities play in supporting each other. The current foster care system is not manageable. Jackie's given you the numbers. The bottom line is that this system is going to implode at some time. It's not going to explode because there's very little there, but it is going to implode. And when that happens, even more children are not going to have access to the basic securities that, you know, that my child has. So the basis of this is to ensure that we prevent the implosion of an already overloaded system. We are promoting the values that are inherent in our culture, not just in our country, but across the continent. We are promoting a system that will be, at the end of the day, considerably more efficient than utilizing social workers to deal with this. There are childcare workers. There are various systems that we can use. But the crux of our proposal is that this committee recommend the establishment of a commission. Now, the reason we're asking for this is not because both Jackie and I are social workers and we're famous for wanting to have endless planning meetings, but the reality is that while kinship care is a very viable solution, we're aware that there are various changes possibly that need to be made to legislation relating to social assistance and social security. Also, we need to bring on board the Treasury and try and build this into the medium-term expenditure framework. We also need to consult widely with people on the ground. We don't just need to consult with child welfare organizations, but we actually need to consult with the people who are doing the work on the ground in the areas that are generally not represented here. These entire proceedings, this bill, this entire process has been conducted largely in English. And it is affecting people who do the work, who are largely illiterate and do not read or write English. So to say that a large degree of our energy has been focused on terms concerning corporal punishment, etc., which is very important, I think what we need to bear in mind here is that this bill is not merely about dealing with corporal punishment. The purpose of it is to make sure that we protect the rights of our children. And in order to do that, we really need your support to be able to look at this alternative approach.
The changes we're proposing to the Children's Amendment Bill to cope with the with the issues in the short term. These are in Annexure A to the submission, which is in front of you. Crucial to our recommendations are the fleshing out of the section from Chapter 8, dealing with prevention and early intervention. Because we believe that a rollout, an intensive national rollout of community-based support services can be built into this chapter. And we have provided a list of types of service which we feel could be included in the definition of prevention and early intervention services, which will address the needs specifically of orphans and vulnerable children. So we're saying also that orphans and vulnerable children shouldn't be addressed all on their own. We are looking at children particularly in poor and traumatized communities who will need services along with all kinds of other children who need support and services. So we will not be singling out the child who happens to be in the foster care of his auntie and doing quite well and giving all the services, trying to get services to that child in isolation from the child next door who's living with an impoverished teenage mother, for instance. These would be support services rolled out within communities, but with components which would address specifically the needs of orphans and vulnerable children. And I won't go through all the categories here because you have them in front of you. We are also asking for, again, a theme throughout the bill for some nays to be replaced with musts to ensure that prevention and early intervention services must be financed, must be planned for in every community, starting with the poorest. We are also recommending that every local authority must develop in cooperation with all relevant local role players an intersectoral plan for supportive services to orphans and vulnerable children. And we're calling for every school to be a node of parent support as has already been mentioned earlier. And we are also asking for a relook, an urgent relook at the provisions that were made in the original bill drafted by the South African Law Reform Commission on informal kinship terms. And there are two clauses from that bill which we are proposing to be reincorporated with some adjustments to them, which could strengthen the position of kinship caregivers. And which could also be the basis for giving access to Social Security without having to go through the courts and without having to be placed on social work caseloads. And I just want to remind everybody who thinks that being on a social work caseload is some kind of magical formula for protection and support. It is not. It absolutely does not help a child in any way to be on the caseload of a social worker whose caseload is so high that he or she cannot possibly pay proper attention to those families. And it also is, in fact, it can be a disadvantage because it can create an illusion that that child is being looked after when that child isn't. So a rollout of easily accessible services on the ground is going to be far, far more effective to those children than the current myth that we've created that, in fact,
Thank you, Madirako. I know I can rely on you. The other day on the City FM, I think you did excellently, for the committee as a whole, by holding the fort there in explaining the intentions of the new legislation on children. Let's open for questions now, and after that we will then proceed. Are there any questions people want to raise? Maybe I should kick off with one question. The whole issue of kinship care. You know, when the Land Committee dealt with the issue of the investigation into the introduction of the current child support grant, the whole question of the grant being extended beyond parents and introducing the notion of primary caregiver raised a further question as to the future of the foster care system. And I'm sure Jackie has been in this game quite, I can remember, beyond, so she's quite knowledgeable on this issue. The difficulty, of course, is that there is this problem that the purpose of foster care, on the one hand, we've been saying that it is better for a child to be cared for within the family and possibly the extended family. And therefore, there's been this gravitation that says that when you do foster care placement, ideally it should be with somebody's relative. But at the same time, we have said a child support grant effectively can be paid to other persons other than the actual natural parents, which include the extended family. So the whole question of whether in a particular situation a person would qualify for a foster care grant. Oh, sorry. So whereas on the one instance we say a person could qualify for a child support grant, that very same child could possibly also be eligible for the foster care grant. Mm. Now, the consequence of this kind of ambiguity in the law or in the arrangement could lead to unequal situations where some children in exactly the same circumstances access the one and the others only access the other, and the rules governing both being different. So I think that's one of the issues around which possibly we may have to refer back to the department for a thorough investigation and a proper report on the way forward. But I'd leave that one at that. Ms. Dudley, were you the first person? Thank you.
Thank you. Not having had enough time really to get my mind around what's specifically written here, but having sort of been watching your input and debate on this for a while, are you saying that whilst we're putting it out there that we need a commission to investigate this, that it is still possible to make relevant changes to this piece of legislation that will still assist the child and assist the system, and you don't see so doing this before the commission is in place and before the investigations, you don't see this, these proposals here as being detrimental in any way, not opening the child in any way to. Okay. And then just wondered if you had the whole idea of schools as nodes of care, which makes an awful lot of sense. Has that been put out there? Has the Department of Education looked at it in any way? Is this a new thought, or is this in some kind of process somewhere else? And is it necessary for us to take that up in this legislation?
Sorry, Weber.
Thank you, Chair. I was just trying to find out, as I haven't had time to go through your documents and some of you in there, but I'd just like to find out, would you want the kinship care to be an extra one on top of having adoption and on top of having foster care and on top of having child support? So we would then be inventing another category. Could you perhaps just explain what would be the advantage of it? You know, just being in kinship when you have got adoption and you have got foster care. Thank you.
Okay, Honorable Mokopanevun.
Thank you very much to the presenters. I just want to ask just one very quick question. I about to say, you know, we always get the debate around not every orphan is vulnerable. And that has an impact as well on foster care, because I also still believe that not every child that ends up in a foster family really does require foster support, foster care support, because at the moment, on the few cases that I've picked up in my constituency, that you find parents who've worked, or a mother or father or both who've passed on, but have left quite enough for their children, and the family. The first problem starts with the master's office. The delays and the settling of estates and everything that goes with it. But also, even when the estate has been settled and everything, if the guardians of those children are exposed to foster care, they still apply for foster care. So you have children who have enough wealth that their parents have left them, but also still adding to the workload of the social workers, and also still adding to the already resources that you know, depriving other really children in need. Now, I just want you to very briefly indicate whether you think the manner in which we've dealt with that question would it take us somewhere in addressing some of those challenges where orphans are categorized, because at the moment it's like just being an orphan automatically makes you a vulnerable child without actually a number of other things being looked at. I just need you,
if the legislation as it stands now would take us somewhere in dealing with that. And if not, what we should say would be over and above the King 50, beyond the King 50.
Okay, the delegation can respond.
I think it starts with question, but that is a question about whether, without detriment to a future process, we could use what are the suggestions at the moment. I would say definitely yes. The submission makes the point that a holistic approach to this whole question would have to involve some changes either to the Social Assistance Act or to the regulations attached to the Social Assistance Act. And that there is no way of dealing with this issue without giving access to Social Security to these hundreds of thousands of children who are impoverished and in need of support. But that part of it, the Social Security part of the equation, is separate from the service delivery part of the equation, because the point is very often made that these are, the vast majority of these are very vulnerable children. Things can go very wrong in their lives and do go very wrong in their lives. Not necessarily more so than some of the other children that are around them. And this is where, Chair, your remark about children in the same situation, but they find themselves in different in separate dispensations, that is absolutely so true of what is happening at the moment. But if we address the specific issues that are picked up in the recommendations here, you will see that what we're asking for is a roll-up that would not involve just the input of social workers, but it would involve every type of social service professional, child and youth care workers who are already playing an important role in this issue, community development workers who are being rolled out in all the local authorities, and a whole host of volunteers of different kinds. If we have a systematic rollout of prevention and early intervention services driven by Chapter 8 of the Act, with all the maize replaced by MUS and the proper national plan for that, then we can start making meaningful things happen on the ground that are easily accessible to these children that will make a difference in their lives. Sitting on a social worker's caseload is not making a difference in their lives. Other than getting in the grant. And they must have access to grants, but in other ways. Schools, as noted, parent support, there are lots of education policy documents that put forward this kind of concept. Some schools are implementing this approach, others are not. But if every school were made to, this would also be an essential part of the issue, and we have also built in a provision around the responsibilities of schools, which did appear in the original Law Commission draft, but was taken out subsequently. We are pleading that it be put back and expanded, because schools are absolutely crucial to making sure that orphans and vulnerable children are properly looked after. An advantage or disadvantage to create a separate category. What we are saying is really this is a separate category. What we have done is taken the concept of foster care and tried to squeeze everybody into that concept so that they can access the foster care grant. So the foster care system is supposed to be primarily part of the protective system against child abuse and abandonment. It has ceased to be that. It is now an income support system for poor families, for orphans. We are saying let the foster care system be what the foster care system is supposed to be, part of the formal child protection system where children have been abused and neglected and where the state has to intervene to actively protect them. There are a whole lot of tasks that a social worker who is delivering a foster care service is supposed to be carrying out. They are listed in the discussion paper. They are not being carried out at the moment because the caseloads make that absolutely answer the question. So children who are in the system that are needing an intensive professional service are not getting that service at all at the moment. So let's take the separate reality, which is the kinship care issue,
call it by a different name because it is a different reality, and then we'll be dealing with it much more efficiently and effectively. Yes, I'm not sure whether the question of whether every orphan is vulnerable, and I would agree some are more vulnerable than others. Some children are not orphans, are more vulnerable than some who are being called vulnerable. And this is why we have to have our services and our strategies geared to making sure that we address what children need in the way that it needs to be addressed. I would suggest that maybe something that we've left out of the list of preventive and early intervention services that could be added into the poll is the whole issue of educating people in the management of the estate of some of these children. Community education around the rights of orphans, which are so often trampled on at the moment. I'm not sure if I have answered what you said, but I know Ritesh has more to say about this.
But just to check something, you see, the act, the first kinship care, can't just remember whether there's something ordered kinship, called ordered kinship care, I'm not sure if it's in there. How does that relate to your proposal? Because if it's already dealt with in the act, it's not an issue before us in relation to this amendment bill. But secondly, if kinship care relates to accessing a grant, doesn't the child support grant already perform that role? Because all forms of kinship, all manner of relatives of a child, and even beyond relatives, could be a neighbor, if they are actually looking after a child, they would qualify for the child support grant. Isn't that solution already provided for in the system? So that the issue of kinship, if anything, might be seen as causing more confusion to an otherwise settled matter.
As far as I know, the term court ordered kinship care has gone from the bill altogether. It certainly was removed from one of the drafts, and I don't know if it's maybe back again, but at some stage I think it was taken out.
What is the legislation saying about kinship? Is it saying anything?
Nothing.
Okay. Can I just get the legal? Yeah. We don't have the concept kinship care at all. Okay. But then it affirms my point. I'm saying, isn't it so that currently you have two systems? You have foster care, you have child support, a child support grant, and a foster care grant. And that a kinship care, in a sense, is subsumed in the child support grant in the context of the primary caregiver. It actually, primary caregiver actually goes beyond kinship because you don't have to be a relative necessarily. And in fact, it solves your other problem where you're saying actually kinship, court ordered kinship care under the guise of foster care would be a problem because it would come with it all this bureaucratic red tape that would slow down the accessing of many children who need support from accessing. So in a sense, that problem is solved by not even introducing the notion of kinship so that only those children who are vulnerable in the eyes of the court and qualify for foster care, take them as foster care. Otherwise, the only other support they would get would be child support. So in a sense, I'm saying the issue seems to be resolved as the legislative arrangement. Would you have difficulty with that?
Yes, Chair, because in practice it's not working like that, and there are a number of reasons. You may remember, Chair, that the Law Commission in the first place set out three scenarios that are taken up in what is currently called foster care. The one is the children who are abused and abandoned and neglected, and the state has intervened and placed them with people who are not related to them. And they then need to have a permanency plan associated with that and a professional service, a course of professional action that has to be taken to assist them, and hopefully with the aim eventually of either going back to their families or permanently being settled in an alternative family. Scenario two would be where a child had been abused or neglected and had to be removed, but members of the family had come forward and said, we will care for this child while this child needs to be in statutory care. But you would still need social work services and a professional component for that. Scenario three, the child is already with TIF and TIN, will remain there forever, probably, and there's a need for some various forms of support service and for access to social security. And that was called informal kinship care. Then as the Act developed, the informal kinship care part of it fell out, and court-ordered kinship care started to be used as the term that would cover all the children who were in care with relatives. And at the moment, no, there's no distinction between anybody, and we've got this term foster care that covers everything. And the problem, of course, is that this huge incentive, which you rightly pointed out, was raised at the time of the Lund Committee. There's a huge incentive to go for the higher foster care grant. So there's been the drive to get all the children into statutory foster care, and of course the grant is far more attractive. And it's non-means tested, and it's much more easily accessible. So you now have an incentive to place your children with relatives.
And for the wealth of the child, of course, but that gets an incentive.
Beg your pardon?
It's the wealth of the foster parent that's not means tested, but the wealth of the child gets an incentive.
That's correct, yes, except there would be very, very few children that would apply to. But at the moment, there are various ideas about how this could be catered for. The one idea that's recently emerged is that there could be two categories of child support grants, the one for a child who is your own child and the one for a child who is a child that's related to you. The other approach would be to either do away with or greatly reduce the gap in the amount between the child support grant and the foster care grant, because that huge gap is responsible for a lot of the problems that we have at the moment. But one thing that we would like to say, and this is, I think, where the idea of an investigation comes in, is that it is not possible to address this issue without addressing the Social Assistance Act. If there were a two-tier child support grant, you at least then would not have to change the Act. You could change the regulations to the Act. So that what is now a foster care grant for a stable kinship arrangement could be, say, a level 2 child support grant. And you could do away with the gap there. But of course that's a hugely controversial, and there needs to be a big debate about that. But that could be one way of doing it.
Okay, is there any final point you want to add?
Chair, that, you know, like we said, that just why we need a commission to deal with this, because and as much as you point out that currently these children are cared for in various ways, in reality on the ground,
the reality on the ground is that the access to both the child support grant and the foster care grant are not, you know, while the department shows the increase in uptake for all of these grants, the reality is that on the ground it is not reaching the most vulnerable children. That's the bottom line. And the suggestion for kinship care, while it might add to the different layers and complexity of the system, is going to create a particular niche for those children who do not have the access that they should be having. And to be able to receive a grant that is substantially higher than the child support grant. It's as simple as that. It is clear that social security is used in South Africa as a means of poverty alleviation. That's the reality. And as much as the state might talk about dependency and wanting to move away from dependency, we need to acknowledge that there are citizens in South Africa who do not have basic food security. And if drugs can go some way towards ensuring that people have basic food security, then I think that that is not an unreasonable thing to happen. Okay, thank you. I think we can only take it to so far. We have serious time constraints. Obviously, this is a matter that will need to be revisited with the department. My understanding is that, in fact, there is a process at some point as part of the investigation into the implementation of the comprehensive social security that would be looking specifically at the area of social security for children. If the officials from the department are in any position to confirm that there is such an investigation, they can do so. But obviously, that it is at that point that we can do justice to this kind of issue. Members, I think that we're going to pause now and have a short tea break, 5 minutes, because we still have 5 presentations to go for the time. Possibly we'll finish up 6 minutes at the pace that we are proceeding now. So I just wanted to check how many of the presenters live in Cape Town are able to allow us to hear them tomorrow, because there is a scheduled meeting of the committee tomorrow at 9. So that we suspend the business of the committee for tomorrow morning and allow the public hearing to spill over into tomorrow. Because there are a number of other logistical problems for members as well. We didn't get the same proceedings going to 5. And by 4:45, this might be under difficulty. We may have Can I get an indication from the remaining presenters if there are any of you who live in Cape Town who would indulge the committee by allowing us to be able to do that tomorrow morning at 9? Any indication?
Chair, I'm Judith Cohen from the Human Rights Commission. I do live in Cape Town, but I will not be able to indulge the committee as I'm flying to Johannesburg first thing tomorrow morning. It's for business which has been booked for quite some time now, and I actually delayed the flight by a day in order to be here today to present.
Okay, and I understood from you that there's another activity that the rest of your colleagues are busy with. So you wouldn't. It wouldn't be possible to replace you tomorrow. Okay, are there any other people who are in a position to endorse the committee?
Okay. The Children's Institute could come back tomorrow.
We'll buy you a cake on the last day of the Children's Institute. Yeah. Yes, who else?
The child wants it, and we're happy to come back tomorrow.
Oh, how sweet of you. Who are the other two people around? As well?
I don't think I'm going to be that sweet. I'm not able to come back tomorrow from Childline.
Childline would be able to come back?
Well.
Oh, okay.
What was the first one?
We
left with 5 presentations, am I correct?
Yes, and two are willing to indulge us. The
other... Four. Oh, it's 5.
Who is the last one that hasn't spoken?
the one that wasn't allowed to speak early on. I'm actually supposed to be presenting as well. Unfortunately, I can't extend until tomorrow.
So we have 2 we can manage. We've got 3 today, so we can manage.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to bulldoze you and give you literally 5 minutes to make a presentation and allow the balance of the time. Maybe another 5 minutes to interact with the presentation. Because quarter to 5 exactly. It does look like it's possible to get a later transport. And I think when I look at that, it's just one. It's in four. Laboratory can be a little. I like anything else. So the only part in the day is the laboratory. Yeah? We got what drive. We got what drive. What drive? Fine. Right. We'll find a way around that. Let's then proceed with the 3 presentations. And tomorrow we will, before we attend to any other business, those that will be coming to us tomorrow, they'll be having a date with us now. So we have a date with the committee tomorrow. Okay. We will start with the 3 presenters is the Human Rights Commission. And anyone amongst the 3 of you who's catching a flight tonight, we'll proceed to the Human Rights Commission and deal with the other. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon to committee members. I'm Judith Cohen. I'm head of the Parliamentary Programme from the South African Human Rights Commission. And first of all, I'd just like to apologize for the fact that our chairperson, Jodie Collipin, and other senior commissioners and staff members are not present today. We are currently conducting a follow-up to our farming inquiry, which we had a few years ago. And the dates were set for this week some time back, so the chairperson has asked that I make the presentation on his behalf. I will, in terms of the directions given by the chairperson of the committee, endeavour to engage as speedily as possible through the submission. There are a few comments that I would like to make on what has already been said today. I think from the Human Rights Commission, what I will be addressing in the following 5 to 10 minutes is that we will be addressing this committee as an institution that supports constitutional democracy, that we will place the issue of corporal punishment very firmly within the constitutional mandate, within the Bill of Rights, and with our international commitments. And in particular, we wish to draw this committee's attention to some recent developments at an international level, which has stated very clearly, very unambiguously, that corporal punishment must be prohibited. And I'm referring here to the United Nations General Comment from the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which came out last year. We'll speak about it further. And I'm also referring to the Global Study on Violence Against Children, which was a global study conducted by the United Nations, which was released last year. And both these documents interpret the Convention on the Rights of the Child and state very clearly and state very unambiguously what the obligations of states are. So first of all, we, as the Commission, we would just really like to commend the process of the drafting of this bill thus far and also for the NCOP Select Committee thus far, which has been busy with the bill. And just to state that as the Commission, we support the prohibition of corporal punishment. We support the defense of reasonable chastisement being abolished. And very loudly and very importantly, we support in the bill the provisions for programs on appropriate discipline and programs for education and awareness raising amongst parents. Just to pass a few comments then before I turn to section 159, I just want to quote very quickly from a Constitutional Court judgment of State versus Williams, which looked at, which removed the use of corporal punishment within the justice sector, the criminal sanction. And there the court said, if the state, as a role model par excellence, treats the weakest, most vulnerable amongst us in a manner which diminishes rather than enhances their self-esteem and human dignity, the danger increases that their regard for a culture of decency and respect for the rights of others will be diminished. And I think this really goes to the core and the heart from where the Human Rights Commission is coming from. We have a culture of violence in this country. Levels of violence, both within society, within the community, and within the home, are far too high. We need to be bold. We need to look to our constitution. We need to look to the international development to be guided from them. And we need to say no to violence in all forms. And that takes me to my next comment, which I just wanted to lead in with. And this comes from the UN General Comment, and it's in terms of, let's be clear, when we're speaking about corporal punishment, what are we meaning? We've had a lot of debates today about what's spanking and slapping and etc. In terms of the UN General Comment, which looks at the Convention of the Rights of the Child, the committee is unambiguous. It says that corporal punishment includes physical force, which is used and intended to cause some degree of pain or discomfort, however light. Most involve hitting, in brackets, smacking, slapping, spanking children with a hand or with an implement, whip, stick, belt, shoe, wooden spoon, etc. But it can also involve, for example, kicking, shaking, or throwing children, scratching, pinching, biting, pulling hair, or boxing ears, forcing children to stay in uncomfortable positions, burning, scalding, or forced ingestion. For example, washing children's mouths out with soap or forcing them to swallow hot spices. In the view of the committee, corporal punishment is invariably degrading. In addition, there are other non-physical forms of punishment which also are cruel and degrading and thus incompatible with the convention. These include, for example, punishment which belittles, humiliates, denigrates, scapegoats, threatens, scares, or ridicules the child. I think there we have it, and that's very clear in terms of when the Human Rights Commission says we must prohibit corporal punishment, that is what we are speaking about. We are unambiguous in this respect, to this regard. I think as well, to pick up on some of the comments that have been passed today, there's been a lot of debate about what is reasonable. And I think that we must remember that the defense of reasonable chastisement has been with us for many a century. It has been used in the past to be a defense to hitting your wife, to hitting your slave, and to hitting your servant, okay? And the Committee on the Rights of the Child emphasizes that the Convention requires the removal of any provisions which allows some degree of violence against children. So at an international level, it's unequivocal, no violence is to be sent meted out against children. In fact, the UN Global Study on Violence Against Children, in their conclusion, Sergio Pinera, who wrote this report, said, none of us can look children in the eye if we continue to approve or condone any form of violence against them. No violence against children is justifiable. Children should never receive less protection than adults. And it also states, he says in his conclusion, that states have the primary responsibility to uphold children's rights to protection and access to services, and, a very loud and, to support families' capacity to provide children with care in a safe environment. To go to the argument which has also been made today, that the state must not meddle behind the door of the home, the UN Global Study, again, is very clear. It says, however, children's rights to life, survival, development, dignity, and physical integrity do not stop at the door of the family home, nor do state obligations to ensure these rights for children stop either. The state is more than entitled, and this legislature and this committee is more entitled, is entitled to legislate in this regard. And also another comment I just wish to point out is, in terms of children's rights, because this is very important and is recognized these days, that we must listen to children as well when we legislate. And something that came through very loud and clear from the children who were consulted during the UN Global Study on Violence is the children highlighted the physical and psychological hurt they suffered through corporal punishment, as a result of forms of corporal punishment. And they articulated the need for positive and alternative forms of discipline. And therefore it has been urged that states at all levels prohibit all forms of violence against children. I then just wish to turn very briefly, I think it's already been spoken about today, at our international obligation in terms of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. South Africa has already tabled and had considered its initial report before that committee. We are currently delayed in taking the second report to the committee, and our third report is almost due. But the UN did say that it's recommended that the state parties take effective measures to prohibit by law the use of corporal punishment in the family. So in other words, the United Nations is expecting the South African state to come back and say what it has done about corporal punishment in the home. Okay? We have already spoken today about whether corporal punishment is African or not African. There again, we have the African Charter on the rights of children. And it states there very clearly that there is an obligation to ensure that domestic discipline is administered with humanity and in a manner which is consistent with the inherent human dignity of the child. Our own constitution, as you know, speaks of equality, dignity, freedom from violence, and also specifically Section 28.1d, the right to be protected from maltreatment, neglect, abuse, or degradation. Turning very briefly then to Section 139, we welcome Section 139. We do wish to just address very specifically Section 139.7, which states, just to remind everyone, that persecution of a parent may be instituted if the punishment constitutes abuse of the child. The Commission has essentially two arguments there and an alternative position. One is that this section has the potential to undermine the provision as a whole, and secondly, that the provision is superfluous. So we would argue that this provision is not needed, it should be removed. One is we argue it has the potential to undermine the provision of Section 139 as a whole, is that the language is completely out of sync with the language in the rest of that provision. And it seems to be creating the impression that you've got corporal punishment, and you've got corporal punishment slash abuse. There is no such distinction. It is clear. Corporal punishment is corporal punishment, no matter how small or how little it is. We would also argue that the section is superfluous. The Roman maxim was ex loesma, the minimus non curat lex, and the law does not concern itself with that is trivial, comes to mind. And therefore, it does not have to be reiterated and restated in that provision. Should though the committee not be convinced by these arguments they are set out in our submission, we would say that in the alternative that clause should be reworded and that the word the punishment constitutes abuse of the child should be replaced with the word it is in the best interest of the child. And this would be very much in keeping with the UN General Comments number 8, which came out last year from the Committee on the Rights of the Child, where it said that children's dependent status and the unique intimacy of family relations demand that decisions to prosecute parents or to formally intervene in the family in other ways should be taken with great care. Prosecuting parents is in most cases unlikely to be in the children's best interests. Okay? It is the committee's view that prosecution and other formal interventions should only proceed where they are regarded both as necessary to protect the child from significant harm and to be in the best interest of the affected child. So changing that word into best interest of the child would certainly be go with the international trends and the most recent international trends that have come out. And therefore, from the Human Rights Commission's point of view, we would really urge this committee to forge ahead with the provisions which are set out within Section 139. We are doing the right thing for the children in this country. We are doing the right thing to ensure that we start in very innovative and different ways to start addressing the levels of violence in this country. We need to take mechanisms. They may not be the most popular course of action for this committee to take, but we have to begin somewhere, and we have to have the legislative framework if we want to do something to ensure that we counter violence in this country. And just finally, just to end off with, and this is also fits in with a comment which is made by the Christian Action Network. I quote, they say that children don't need the same rights as parents. Just to finish off with then, from the general comment, it says, it is the distinct nature of children, their initial dependence and developmental state, their unique human potential as well as their vulnerabilities, all demand the need for more rather than less legal and other protection from all forms of violence. Corporal punishment must be one of the last state-sanctioned forms of violence that sits on our statute books in this country and many countries around the world, and it is time for this committee to be bold and say no more violence against children in our country, and we are contributing towards a culture of non-violence in this wonderful, beautiful country of ours. Thank you, Chair.
It's open for discussion, members. Any particular questions? I would like to perhaps kick off by asking one or two questions. You read out, well, first of all, I like the quote from the African Charter on Children's Rights, which this Parliament is a signatory to, because there has been this debate about the African child. Are we imposing Eurocentric norms and values on the African child? We need the space to raise the African child the African way. And I think that what is said in that convention on the rights of the African child, to which we are signatory, I just wanted to highlight that. But I just wanted to further say that the issue of one, there was a suggestion that perhaps we should have a period, a cooling off period, before this legislation kicks in full swing and allow for the space for
public reorientation, because it's a cultural thing, not necessarily an African culture, but a cultural thing is in society in general that may need to be gradually over time, you know, addressed. I want your comment on that one. I also, you see, I see the point that which we raised earlier, that the law doesn't concern itself. It's trivial, therefore, you know, the prosecution is not going to clock in the role with a situation where some mother tries to, you know, left a child, kept the child's bottom because they wanted to put emphasis on a particular issue. But at the same time, there is this argument that the law must assert people need to know upfront what is lawful and what is not lawful. Now, it came with a whole lengthy definition, for example, of what constitutes corporal punishment, what constitutes abusive punishment. Do you think that we actually do need to write that kind of lengthy definition into the law to create certainty? Because as it stands, I don't know, it's certain in everybody's mind what constitutes a reasonable chastisement, you know, despite the fact that it's demanded. Yeah. So I'm just saying, to what extent should we be making things more certain and more clear? To what extent should we be making things more clear in the law, and if so, in what way would you propose that we do that? I don't know if there are other questions, but you can respond to them. Okay, please proceed.
I would like to agree with your comments that it is very important for us to place the whole debate around corporal punishment within the context of the African child. And as was pointed out earlier today, there are many wonderful traditions and sayings within the African culture, such as it takes a village to raise a child, you can't raise a child by hitting the child. It's of interest that very often when one has these phone-in programs on the radio, there was one just this weekend on Saturday around lunchtime, that there are a large number of black men who are fathers calling in, who say on the radio wave, this is not the way to bring up children. So it's clearly embedded, even when you listen to these radio programs, it's coming through very strongly. And even some recent polls in South Africa indicate that there are many, many parents out there who do not support the use of any form of violence whatsoever in terms of corporal punishment. In terms of a cooling off period being written into the legislation, no, from the Human Rights Commission's point of view, we certainly would not support that. I think there is a clear need for the legislative framework to be put in place and for there to be certainty. Legislation will not necessarily change things overnight, but it has been demonstrated that it does have the capacity to change attitudes very quickly, and it will certainly force people and challenge people and parents who are still using corporal punishment to rethink, to engage, and for there to be debate stimulated amongst parents as to what are more appropriate forms of discipline. And certainly as we pass this legislation, there are provisions in the legislation for the education and awareness program. And as was said earlier, the work will begin for the Human Rights Commission, for civil society organizations, for government, for churches. It will begin for everyone in the schools, even teaching children themselves, okay, about appropriate discipline. That is when the real work is going to begin. But we have to have the legislative framework in place in order to do that. I think in terms of trivia, what is trivia, should we start defining corporal punishment? This is a difficult one because one can start going down slippery roads. We've already heard a lot of debates here today about certain forms of punishment are reasonable. I mean, one presenter thought it's perfectly reasonable to take a four-year-old into a bathroom and to hit the child. Other people in this room certainly were not in agreement with that. One can also then start going down the route that some of the states in the United States have gone down, where you start saying how hard you can hit the child, how many times you can hit the child. Many of these debates sound quite medieval and archaic, and I think the question to ask, if we were debating legislation regarding domestic violence and can men hit women, we would be outraged. We would be very clear. So it is simple, no violence. Are you allowed to just slap your wife? Are we going to go home and say it's fine for people to slap wives and girlfriends? No, it's not acceptable. Children are more vulnerable than women. They are less disempowered to be able to reach out when they are the victims of violence. So I think we should be clear and unambiguous. If the committee feels strongly, though, that there is a need for some form of definition, then the kind of definition we would support would be that kind of definition which is in the General Comment, and we'll make copies of the General Comment and the UN Global Study and provide them to the committee. But it would have to be that very clear and unambiguous definition which is stated in that UN General Comment, which makes it very clear and very explicit as to what exactly is corporal punishment. And that is a very broad overarching term that involves all forms of both physical and psychological violence.
Yeah, I think that we would appreciate that input. Certainly, I think the intent after might just also be necessary to be included in such a definition. Because I think that, you know, that's where the damage happens. Because even if you shout at the child, if the purpose is to actually, you know, traumatize the child a little bit so that he can still, you know, comply with the child. Yeah, the damage sometimes can
be. Okay, just to be cheeky, isn't that loving discipline?
So let's leave it at that. Let's entertain the second from the last presentation for the day. And that is Child Line.
And I was just saying, why don't you take the individuals just to have that break between organizations?
In any case, it's the second from the last.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Okay, Chair and Committee. My name is Vicky Fransman, and I am representing Childline South Africa this afternoon. Apologies from our national coordinator, Joan Fanica. She is unable to be here due to a prior commitment that was set a while ago. It is of note that Childline is a national network of provincial Childline service providers with 8 affiliated members. Received over 950,000 calls to the toll-free crisis line during 2006 from children and adults with concerns about children. That we've interacted with over 1 million children through school prevention and education programs on the issue of child protection. That we've offered therapy services to over 6,000 children during 2006, and that we network extensively among state and NGO providers of services to children in order to link them to services. We believe that the nature and extent of our contact with children, families, parents and caregivers, as well as partner organizations who assist us in providing services to children, has informed our comment on the Children's Act Amendment Bill.
our submission is as follows. Partial key. Childline welcomes the provisions in the chapter on partial key, particularly the clear definition of partial key, the provision for national and provincial strategies for partial key, the development of provincial profiles of partial care, the section on norms and standards, the inclusion that relate to children with disabilities. Childline notes that partial care facilities do contribute effectively to child protection through the provision of care to children who otherwise would be left unsupervised and possibly in very vulnerable conditions at home or on the street while parents and caregivers are in employment, either formal or informal. However, we do recommend that in Section 86, conditional registration have a clear maximum time limit to prevent children in partial care being kept in conditions that are not protective of their best interests. In Section 79, norms and standards, partial care facilities must be required to develop child protection policies. We often receive numerous calls relating to child abuse and neglect in partial care facilities. And very few partial care facilities for children have a clear policy for the management of allegations of child abuse, either by staff of the facility, whether they be volunteer paid, or the management of children whose behavior places other children at risk. Furthermore, there should be some norm and standard that refers to the optimal management of children's behavior in such facilities, focusing on the use of positive discipline. Our general comments with regard to child protection in Section 104, the development of a comprehensive intersectoral strategy aimed at securing a properly resourced, coordinated and managed child protection system at both national and provincial levels is welcomed. Our recommendation in Section 105.5 is that the designated child protection services must include the psychosocial treatment of children who have experienced abuse and severe physical and emotional neglect. There is overwhelming research evidence indicating that systemic neglect as the psychosocial needs of abused and severely neglected children may contribute to the later adulthood difficulties and maladjustment and difficulties in relation to their own parenting function. We often find this when we offer therapeutic services to children and interact with adults, the mothers particularly, where they are survivors of abuse themselves. It's noted that in Section 106 that there is provision for norms and standards for therapeutic programs. Reporting of child in need of care and protection. Childline welcomes the limited mandated reporting clause and list of mandated reporters. However, we would like to express concern about the wording of Section 110.1. Conclude, and Section 110.3a must substantiate that conclusion or belief. Many of the occupations listed, as well as any person in Section 110.2, will not have training in clearly identifying child abuse and the management of the abused child. We often come across a number of instances where unskilled people will do the investigation and try and get the details from the child, and that often causes secondary trauma to the child as well as the families that are supporting the child. Childline would like to recommend that the wording believes on reasonable grounds should be used in both sub-clauses and that these reasonable grounds must be reported to the provincial department, designated child protection organization or police official. Children who present the termination of pregnancy. Our recommendation. In an earlier version of the Children's Act Amendment Bill, there was a clause requiring professionals who work in termination of pregnancy clinics to report to the child protection system if they suspected the pregnancy was a result of child abuse. This clause, however, appears to have been excluded from the present version of the bill. We strongly recommend the inclusion of the following provision as a subsection of Section 110. That children under the age of 16 years who are pregnant and who present for any medical and or gynecological or obstetric examination or treatment, including the termination of pregnancy, be referred to the child protection system for investigation and appropriate services. We've worked with numerous children who have fallen pregnant as a result of sexual abuse and as has been mentioned earlier, very often happens in the home. We find that about 70% of cases of child abuse happens in the home. They will have a termination of pregnancy, but will then return to the abusive environment. So if children are then referred to the corrective services, an investigation can take place. It is therefore essential that a clause in the Children's Act clearly spells out the responsibility of the medical profession in this instance. The age of 16 years is motivated as this is the age at which a child may consent to a sexual relationship. Even if the child is sexually active in a mutually consenting relationship with the peer, this opens up the opportunity for the child to obtain counseling on responsible sexual behavior. Our overall comment on the child protection system. At present, the child protection system is overwhelmed with foster care applications, as we've heard in previous submissions, from persons who have assumed parental responsibility for orphaned and other vulnerable children. Many of these children have not experienced abuse or severe neglect, and the application for foster care is solely for the provision of income to the caregiver. At present, children requiring referral for child protection services may wait while remaining in a situation of abuse for months on end for that service to be provided. Many referrals of children from our crisis line to state and NGO services receive the barest minimum of attention when the child is seen by a social worker because of the pressure of foster care applications for orphans and vulnerable children. The large difference between the child support grant and the foster care grant contributes to the situation where a caregiver who is not the biological parent will not apply for the CSG, as it is simply not adequate to provide for the child. We therefore support familial care over institutional care for orphans and vulnerable children, and therefore support the provision of the more adequate grant in order to keep orphans and vulnerable children in families and communities. The ban on corporal punishment and the focus on enabling parents and caretakers to develop a positive disciplinary practices. Childline welcomes the focus on promoting positive discipline and the ban on corporal punishment contained in the section of the bill. Childline is very concerned about the high levels of crime and violence that children suffer. Last year, we took about 20,000 calls on our crisis line, where children were phoning in with regard to physical abuse that they were experiencing in the home. The majority of physical abuse cases were related to parental or caretaker efforts to discipline with the use of corporal punishment, and this resulted in physical injury to the child. We believe strongly that children should be afforded the same rights to physical safety and integrity as adults. South Africa has taken a strong stand on the issue of domestic violence through the district.
Is there a written report that you could afford in relation to the calling center service that you've been providing, that we have a sense of the kind of issue? Thank you.
So South Africa has taken a stand against domestic violence. With the legislation that's been passed, and any form of physical smacking or hitting is clearly prescribed between adults. Children, unfortunately, as yet, are not afforded the same protection, and often they need more protection than that. We also receive calls on our crisis line from parents who are aware that corporal punishment is not effective, but don't know about alternatives that they can use with the children. Say that we support and endorse the following submissions that are not made orally, but they have been made to written submissions. The Disabled Children's Action Group, with a specific focus on children with disabilities, the National Association of Child Care Workers, the submission from the Caring Schools Network, and any further submissions from the Childline Provincial Structures throughout the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments from members? I didn't hear.
Thank you very much. I think Childline has been one of the organizations that were very consistent
out in the provinces, and to date the submissions have addressed the same issues that we've engaged with in all the provinces that we've been to. So we've really engaged with the presenters at all the provinces, and it was the same presentation.
Thank you very much. I think that is a an indication that your inputs are firmly within the scope or the firmly within the view of the commission. So we'll take account of those.
Okay,
thank you very much. We proceed to the last presenter, and that is her name is Heidi from the University of Amsterdam. It's your opportunity, ma'am.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity for me to present this work that I've been basically working on for the past few months now. Just to give you a background of what I'm doing, I'm actually a researcher, I'm an anthropologist, and I'm working with children who perpetrate violence. So what I'm doing, I'm working specifically with children who are in trouble with the law, and this age group is not necessarily with adolescents, but with young children. So I'm looking at the age of 14 younger. I'm working in a place of safety in Cape Town. While reading the bill, and just some of the things that came to my attention is, firstly, one of the things that really stood out to me was, if you look within the specific context, when you look within a place of safety, a lot of the time, when children are usually referred to, and in this bill as well, it's always as victims or survivors of violence. However, what this project does, and the difference of this project, is that it deals with children and how they actually negotiate and how they use violence as a positive, so-called positive form for themselves. So what makes this really interesting is, and by the way this bill is actually being presented, is that the concepts that are being used when we speak about safe environment, when we speak about in the best interest of the child, all of this might not necessarily be with the exclusion of violence. Instead, that when I deal with these boys that I work with at the place of safety, a lot of them use violence as a way of creating a safe environment for them, or also creating a sense of where it's in their best interest, because if they don't perpetrate this violence, or if they don't perpetrate any kind of criminal activity, then this somehow is not going to assist in their daily activity. So what I think is really important, what needs to be done with this bill also, is take into account the different contexts. Because I'm thinking that within these specific contexts and within the space of safety, for instance, and not only the place of safety, but also in various townships, for instance, not saying that's the only place where violence is being perpetrated, but in this kind of settings, we have to take into consideration that these contexts also somehow encourage this kind of behavior. That these boys have to somehow perpetrate this violence in a way of gaining what they perceive as respect. Another thing that also came out was that with this bill, there's no specific attention is being paid to children in trouble with the law. That what I see is that there's the mention of child and youth care centers and also alternative care. However, if we look at the children who are committing crime, part of my job and as an anthropologist is that I actually have to be with these boys. So I'm with them in these institutions, in the place of safety, but also following them to court, being a part of their daily activities. And what I've noticed is that these boys, with these, what I refer to as in-between stages, that these boys are not actually, what happens is that they're not protected within this time. So when these boys are being transferred from the place of safety in the police van, having to go from the police van, going to court, having to sit down in these court cells at the court all the time, and they exposed to such a lot of violence in these places as well. So my question would be, how do we protect these boys as well? Not only children who are somehow abused or somehow the victims of violence, but also these children who are perpetrating violence.
Saying there's a perpetuation of violent behavior
in the context
yes.
of the confines of that whole scenario.
Yeah, so you, I actually have with on numerous occasions, these boys who I'm following who are going to court, for instance, they are exposed to such a lot of violence in these police cells as well, in the court. So when on so many different court appearances that I went to so far, you know, going back and being able to have that privilege of going there and seeing this, where I would speak to the boys that I'm dealing with, and they would say, you know, that they're being robbed when they get into the van already, or they're being robbed when they come to the court appearances. So needless to say, this is really anxiety-provoking and traumatizing event. So my question then would be, how does this bill, and how is this going to impact on this, and what difference is this going to make? Because how are we going to deal with this, and whose responsibility is this? Is this the responsibility of the policeman? Is this the responsibility of the judges, the lawyers, the boys? Are they supposed to see to themselves? And this is exactly the thing, that this violence that they're using is not necessarily something that's bad for them. Okay, their perception is that they have to use this, because if they get into that van and they've been beaten up and this old stuff is being stolen, they're going to use force. So somehow, these structures also that are in place...
Beaten up by whom? By the other boys?
By other boys. By other boys. And not just by other boys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, by supposed to be caregivers. People who are supposed to be looking after these boys. And that would be my next step, where I would say that when I look at the management of these boys and when I look at the staff and people who are supposed to be caregivers and people who are supposed to be protecting the children, under the assumption that these children can't protect themselves, of course, but children who, these people who are supposed to be protecting these children are overworked. They are, most of them suffer from vicarious trauma. They traumatized by the work that they do. You have care workers who are sitting 12 hours within these places of safety, expecting to be at peak all the time, constantly being confronted and constantly being challenged by these boys. So if these people who are supposed to, these structures that are in place, if they are unable to, not necessarily unable to, but if it's such a challenge and so difficult for them to do this and to be looking after these boys, how do we deal with this? Because then who's going to be looking after these boys? If the people that are supposed to be in place, who are supposed to be giving this to them, and who are supposed to be protecting these children, if they are unable to do this for whatever reason, whose responsibility is it then? Another thing also with this bill, and referring specifically, and I'm only referring to places of safety and children who are in trouble with the law. Another thing also is that when we have specific people, we also have to realize that these children are in a position of where they feel that they don't have that much power compared to so many other people of status. And being in the system as well, you also have instances where these boys are actually going to court and they're supposed to be presented and lawyers don't turn up. So if we're saying that we as a state should be dealing with this kind of stuff and that we're supposed to be protecting, and this is the idea of this bill, then I would say with the criminals, with the children who are involved in this, all the children who are somewhere in trouble with the law, we are failing them hopelessly. And I think that is definitely a part that we should really be looking at, and especially the thing around places of safety. This is something extremely important. It's an awaiting trial section, so it's where these boys are constantly in state, where it's this liminal state, say in between. They've not been sentenced and they have to be in this place. The facilities around these places are nothing next to perfect. The schooling that they have there, I mean, that's like 1 hour a day or something. So what are we doing then? What is this place of safety? I don't think it's a place of safety at all. I would definitely also rethink that concept. Thanks.
I assume if you're raising the questions, you will be able to assist with the answers as well.
I'm an academic, so we just throw out the questions.
And I'm also interested in international best practice. as an academic, I'm sure you have access to information about how other countries in similar situations have managed the situation. If there is any that you would want to share with us, would certainly appreciate that. But I don't know if members have any questions. Honorable Bokopan, Bruno?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There are just three things that I think I need to talk to. The first thing, ma'am, I would like to say that there is a child justice law that's very, very clear, that deals very specifically to the category of children you are saying. So I want to suggest that you familiarize yourself with it, because this is where this bill and children in conflict with the law, and why you feel this particular one, because the Child Justice Bill Act is about them and how services and everything needs to respond to children in conflict with the law, because it's a category of children. What I would say is that on this one, it's about making sure that they don't become, they don't end up as children in conflict with the law. That is the focus of this one. And if they do get in conflict with the law, then something else comes in, and it's not this one. Because this one is about social services. So that is the first part that I thought I needed to talk to. The second part, having said that, is that yes, social development, the places of safety, once we finish this bill, will be changed. Will be changed to centers, and automatically when you change something to something, it's accompanied by programs and by the name, because everywhere when we talk about child and youth care centers, that also includes places of safety, because somehow we look into all the sections that talk to child and youth care. Maybe you were looking for specifically wanting to see the way places of safety. We're moving away from that, and the concept is that if we change the services that we're providing there, and then the service needs to be different. The other aspect is obviously if you look at the Correctional Services Act, I think amendment or something that's before that is. It's not a huge section, but it's a small section, and the section deals with two, three things. Obviously, the duration of the baby, the duration a baby can stay in prison with the mother, but it also deals with some of the issues that you say around the transporting and the protection. It has a section that deals with children under the age of 18 that are in conflict with the law, that are in correctional facilities. And that leads me to the last point, Jay, that I think this is my personal view, that as much as we would want to make places, let me say, for children awaiting silence, to have all the aspects of the system they are entitled to, but at the same time, we should not make the extreme of it, because then we would, in a way, defeating what we are trying. We need to first make sure they never even get there. They never get to the point. Hence, the critical emergence of a different mode of parenting, a different breed of parents are required to make sure that we don't even get them to be in conflict with the law. That's the one thing. But if they are there, from a social development perspective, that's what we would try and do. But once they are in conflict with the law, most of the time they belong to justice and they belong to correctional services, because now they are going through a criminal system. And to an extent, as much as we do checks and balances, I think we would definitely, at some stage, Chair, before we conclude, look at the Child Justice Bill and this one and see where are the overlaps and where are the gaps, and get to a point maybe where we find a way from a service perspective, because this is a Section 76, how would the two bills be compatible?
Okay, maybe you want to respond, because I don't know if Dr. Mavito is still here.
if she could just clarify just which of the facilities fall within the purview of this act, at which ones they fall outside. Maybe you could do that first and then she can respond to the question.
Thank you. I think as Honorable Kofapani Zulu has indicated, the parameters of, you know, tyranny are in conflict with the law. It is on. The care of children were in conflict with the law. It's really within, it's provided for within the Child Justice Bill. Although the Child Justice Bill is not an act as yet, but we are implementing it as social development in collaboration within the child justice, within the justice sector, the JCPS sector, it's ourselves, SAPS and Correctional Services and the Department of Justice. The Department of Social Development is responsible for the children while they are awaiting trial, and we place them in secure care facilities. And in some provinces where they do not have adequate secure care facilities, they are also placed in the section, in a specific section, in a place of safety, which cares specifically for those children. And the transportation of children from...
So technically, there could be children in conflict with the law who are in a place of safety.
Oh, yes.
As opposed to a secure care.
Yeah, yeah.
Would that be regulated by this law or by the child justice law?
It is both ways, sir, that the care of those children, once they're in a place of safety, of course they have to be taken care of in accordance to the regulations that regulate place of safety. But because they are awaiting trial, they also have to be cared for in accordance within the understanding that, you know, they are not placed there by a children's court order. They are there awaiting trial. So their problems will definitely be different from the problems of children that are there for a longer period of time. And I think that the difficult situation is that we see this is the secure care facilities, and even children who are in prison, like the portfolio community with the correctional services in Pretoria, we find that these children are there for half a day, for a day, or for 3 months, or for 1 year. So you can never know. And hence, there is a move to provide them with programs where it is possible. But most of the time, you cannot have a specific program for a child because they are there for a very, very, you know, a short period of time. And but at the moment, the provinces are also moving towards moving those children out of place of safety into to be properly cared for in secure care facilities. Yesterday we were with Treasury and we were looking for more funding to build secure care facilities across the country. Because secure care facilities, I think, is the right place for these children and they've got problems in the infrastructure. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. I think that we will have an opportunity at some point to deal with this cross-cutting issues between the different legislative processes. But I don't know if you want to respond to some of the comments and questions from Honorable Bokhubanizo.
To add one thing, I think the discussion that's happening is also the cross-cutting happens, determined, if you remember, by the severity of the crime the child committed. So that in itself makes the cross-cutting even more difficult because when the child is classified based on the age and the type of crime, that poses a serious challenge. I mean, if you had a 13-year-old just saving lives, I mean.
Conversely, if you're going to have an 8-year or 9-year-old who committed a minor offense, you can't have them mixing with the hardened criminals who are obviously going to abuse and traumatize them. But anyway, okay, please do.
Another complication is that secure care facilities are part of the child and youth care centers.
So there will be regulations and the norms and standards will be part of the norms and standards for child and youth care centers. And I think your mention that we need to look at the linkages is very, very important, because we're looking after the children within this, in our facilities, within this law, but they're really part of the child justice bill.
So are you saying that the norms and standards regarding the care of these children in this child and youth care centers, which include secure care centers, or specifically in secure care centers, would have to be dealt with in this law? I see. So her comments are actually relevant. Okay. Please respond.
I just have there's too many discussions going on, so I'm just trying to follow the ones that I can actually do at this moment now, because my head is really spinning now, because there's way too much questions that I can actually pose. But firstly, this idea of the secure care facility, this child and youth care center, my concern is that we're going to come up with all these different concepts, but I would think that the idea is basically trying to deal with the well-being of the child. Of also, based on this idea of the best interest of the child, I don't know whose perception this really is. The best interest, or children saying that this is in their best interest, or is this adult perception? But that's a completely different discussion. But coming back to this,
precisely for that reason. Overarching concept was introduced so that you have norms and standards, which obviously would have to be nuanced in relation to the different categories of children you're dealing with, but where you have a whole system that regulates comprehensively the care of children in so-called child and youth care centers, which would include secure care facilities. So in a sense, it solves the problem of saying a child is a child, irrespective of the facility in which they are, and the issue of care manifests itself in all those situations. But please proceed with the comment.
The one thing that I also, what I think is two things that I think are important is that, firstly, these children are waiting trial. None of them are sentenced. Most of them, when they're sentenced, they have to wait for placement in another reformatory or wherever, child, youth center, or whatever you want to call it, and then they move. So what actually happens is that these children are not necessarily, technically, they are not really, they're in trouble with the law based on the assumption, but they haven't been sentenced yet. So it's also something where, yeah, exactly. So they might be innocent. So we haven't been in this facility already. I mean, this is already sending a specific message that this child is in trouble with the law. However, that might not necessarily be the case. So that doesn't mean that these children shouldn't be getting specific kind of basic needs also within these places of safety. That also things around health facilities. These kind of things need to be explored in these places. I have a lot for this.
Your point is well taken. In fact, we picked it up when we went to the prison, the central prison in Tshwane last month, where it was clear that the children who are awaiting trial are in actually a more disadvantageous position than the sentenced children. Because once the sentence is clear, the whole program needs to be developed education-wise, etc. But when you are awaiting trial, it's not known, as somebody said, whether you're going to wait for half a day or for the whole year. And in the meantime, if you end up waiting for a year, you lose a whole year of tuition, etc. And of course, if you are acquitted, even after that whole long wait, you have completely lost out. Hence, Dr. Madeka was alluding to this talk of looking at programs that could be tailor-made to accommodate children. But we will see how that is going. But thanks for that input, and I think it was a very useful input for thought. I think we've reached the point where we're going to pause for the day.
And resume our proceedings tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock sharp.